The least wrinkle crept into his brow as he remembered that this was February 2nd, the time the man always called. He fished down in his pocket for his purse, getting the first taste of paying out when nothing is coming in. He looked at the fat green roll as a sick man looks at the one possible saving cure. Then he counted off $28. "Here you are," he said to Carrie when she came through again. He buried himself in his papers and read. Oh, the rest of it. The relief from walking and thinking. What Lethean waters were these floods of telegraphed intelligence? He forgot his troubles, in part. Here was a young, handsome woman, if you might believe the newspaper drawing, suing a rich, fat, candy-making husband in Brooklyn for divorce. Here was another item detailing the wrecking of a vessel in ice and snow off Prince's Bay on Staten Island. A long, bright column told of the doings in the theatrical world, the plays produced, the actors appearing, the managers making announcements. Fanny Davenport was just opening at the Fifth Avenue. Daly was producing King Lear. He read of the early departure for the season of a family composed of the Vanderbilts and their friends for Florida. An interesting shooting affray was on in the mountains of Kentucky. So he read, 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 rocking in the warm room near the radiator and waiting for dinner to be served. XXXV. The passing of effort, the visage of care. The next morning he looked over the papers and waded through a long list of advertisements, making a few notes. Then he turned to the Mail Help Wanted column, but with disagreeable feelings. The day was before him, a long day in which to discover something, and this was how he must begin to discover. He scanned the long column, which mostly concerned bakers, bushelmen, cooks, compositors, drivers, and the like, finding two things only which arrested his eye. One was a cashier wanted in a wholesale furniture house, and the other a salesman for a whiskey house. He had never thought of the latter. At once he decided to look that up. The firm in question was Alsbury & Company, whiskey brokers. He was admitted almost at once to the manager on his appearance. "Good morning, sir," said the latter, thinking at first that he was encountering one of his out-of-town customers. "Good morning," said Hurstwood. "You advertised, I believe, for a salesman?" "Oh," said the man, showing plainly the enlightenment which had come to him. "Yes, yes, I did." "I thought I'd drop in," said Hurstwood with dignity. "I've had some experience in that line myself." "Oh, have you?" said the man. "What experience have you had?" "Well, I've managed several liquor houses in my time. Recently I owned a third interest in a saloon at Warren and Hudson Streets." "I see," said the man. Hurstwood ceased, waiting for some suggestion. "We did want a salesman," said the man. "I don't know if it's anything you'd care to take hold of, though." "I see," said Hurstwood. "Well, I'm in no position to choose just at present. If it were open, I should be glad to get it." The man did not take kindly at all to his "no position to choose." He wanted someone who wasn't thinking of a choice or something better, especially not an old man. He wanted someone young, active, and glad to work actively for a moderate sum. Hurstwood did not please him at all. He had more of an air than his employers. "Well," he said in answer, "we'll be glad to consider your application. We shan't decide for a few days yet. Suppose you send us your references." "I will," said Hurstwood. He nodded good morning and came away. At the corner he looked at the furniture company's address and saw that it was in West 23rd Street. Accordingly, he went up there. The place was not large enough, however. It looked moderate, the men in it idle and small-salaried. He walked by, glancing in, and then decided not to go in there. "They want a girl, probably, at 10 a week, he said. At 1 o'clock he thought of eating and went to a restaurant in Madison Square. There he pondered over places which he might look up. He was tired. It was blowing up gray again. Across the way, through Madison Square Park, stood the great hotels looking down upon a busy scene. He decided to go over to the lobby of one and sit a while. It was warm in there and bright. He had seen no one he knew at the Broadway Central. In all likelihood, he would encounter no one here. Finding a seat on one of the red plush divans close to the great windows which look out on Broadway's busy route, he sat, musing. His state did not seem so bad in here. Sitting still and looking out, he could take some slight consolation in the few $100 he had in his purse. He could forget, in a measure, the weariness of the street and his tiresome searches. Still, it was only escape from a severe to a less severe state. He was still gloomy and disheartened. There, minutes seemed to go very slowly. An hour was a long, long time in passing. It was filled for him with observations and mental comments concerning the actual guests of the hotel who passed in and out, and those more properous pedestrians whose good fortune showed in their clothes and spirits as they passed along Broadway outside. It was nearly the first time since he had arrived in the city that his leisure afforded him ample opportunity to contemplate this spectacle. Now, being, perforce, idle himself, he wondered at the activity of others. How gay were the youths he saw! How pretty the women! Such fine clothes they all wore! They were so intent upon getting somewhere. He saw coquettish glances cast by magnificent girls. Ah, the money it required to train with such! How well he knew! How long it had been since he had had the opportunity to do so. The clock outside registered 4. It was a little early, but he thought he would go back to the flat. This going back to the flat was coupled with the thought that Carrie would think he was sitting around too much if he came home early. He hoped he wouldn't have to, but the day hung heavily on his hands. Over there he was on his own ground. He could sit in his rocking chair and read. This busy, distracting, suggestive scene was shut out. He could read his paper. Accordingly, he went home. Carrie was reading, quite alone. It was rather dark in the flat, shut in as it was. "You'll hurt your eyes," he said when he saw her. After taking off his coat, he felt it incumbent upon him to make some little report of his day. "I have been talking with a wholesale liquor company," he said. "I may go out on the road."
"Wouldn't that be nice?" said Carrie.
"It wouldn't be such a bad thing," he answered. Always from the man at the corner now, he bought 2 papers, the Evening World and the Evening Sun. So now he merely picked his papers up as he came by without stopping. He drew up his chair near the radiator and lighted the gas. Then it was as the evening before. His difficulties vanished, and the items he so well loved to read. The next day was even worse than the one before, because now he could not think of where to go. Nothing he saw in the papers he studied till 10 o'clock appealed to him. He felt that he ought to go out, and yet he sickened at the thought. Where to? Where to?
"You mustn't forget to leave me my money for this week," said Carrie quietly.
They had an arrangement by which he placed $12 a week in her hands, out of which to pay current expenses. He heaved a little sigh as she said this and drew out his purse. Again he felt the dread of the thing. Here he was, taking off, and nothing coming in. "Lord," he said in his own thoughts, "this can't go on." To Carrie he said nothing whatsoever. She could feel that her request disturbed him. To pay her would soon become a distressing thing.
"Yet what have I got to do with it?" she thought. "Oh, why should I be made to worry?"
Hurstwood went out and made for Broadway. He wanted to think up some place. Before long, though, he reached the Grand Hotel at 31st Street. He knew of its comfortable lobby. He was cold after his 20 blocks walk. "I'll go in their barber shop and get a shave," he thought. Thus he justified himself in sitting down in here after his tonsorial treatment. Again, time hanging heavily on his hands, he went home early, and this continued for several days, each day the need to hunt paining him, and each day disgust, depression, shamefacedness driving him into lobby idleness. At last, 3 days came in which a storm prevailed, and he did not go out at all. The snow began to fall late one afternoon. It was a regular flurry of large, soft white flakes. In the morning it was still coming down with a high wind, and the papers announced a blizzard. From out the front windows one could see a deep, soft bedding. "I guess I'll not try to go out today," he said to Carrie at breakfast. "It's going to be awful bad, so the papers say." "The man hasn't brought my coal either," said Carrie, who ordered by the bushel. "I'll go over and see about it," said Hurstwood. This was the first time he had ever suggested doing an errand, but somehow the wish to sit about the house prompted it as a sort of compensation for the privilege. All day and all night it snowed, and the city began to suffer from a general blockade of traffic. Great attention was given to the details of the storm by the newspapers, which played up the distress of the poor in large type. Hurstwood sat and read by his radiator in the corner. He did not try to think about his need of work. This storm being so terrific and tying up all things robbed him of the need. He made himself wholly comfortable and toasted his feet. Carrie observed his ease with some misgivings. For all the fury of the storm, she doubted his comfort. He took his situation too philosophically. Hurstwood, however, read on and on. He did not pay much attention to Carrie. She fulfilled her household duties and said little to disturb him. The next day it was still snowing, and the next bitter cold. Hurstwood took the alarm of the paper and sat still. Now he volunteered to do a few other little things. One was to go to the butcher, another to the grocery. He really thought nothing of these little services in connection with their true significance. He felt as if he were not wholly useless, indeed, in such a stress of weather, quite worthwhile about the house. On the fourth day, however, it cleared, and he read that the storm was over. Now, however, he idled, thinking how sloppy the streets would be. It was noon before he finally abandoned his papers and got under way. Owing to the slightly warmer temperature, the streets were bad. He went across 14th Street on the car and got a transfer south on Broadway. One little advertisement he had, relating to a saloon down in Pearl Street. When he reached the Broadway Central, however, he changed his mind. "What's the use?" he thought, looking out upon the slop and snow. "I couldn't buy into it. It's 1,000 to 1 nothing comes of it. I guess I'll get off." And off he got. In the lobby he took a seat and waited again, wondering what he could do. While he was idly pondering, satisfied to be inside, a well-dressed man passed up the lobby, stopped, looked sharply as if not sure of his memory, and then approached. Hurstwood recognized Cargill, the owner of the large stables in Chicago of the same name, whom he had last seen at Avery Hall the night Carrie appeared there. The remembrance of how this individual brought up his wife to shake hands on that occasion was also on the instant clear. Hurstwood was greatly abashed. His eyes expressed the difficulty he felt. "Why, it's Hurstwood," said Cargill, remembering now, and sorry that he had not recognized him quickly enough in the beginning to have avoided this meeting. "Yes," said Hurstwood. "How are you?" "Very well," said Cargill, troubled for something to talk about. "Stopping here?" "No," said Hurstwood, "just keeping an appointment." "I knew you had left Chicago. I was wondering what had become of you." "Oh, I'm here now," answered Hurstwood, anxious to get away. "Doing well, I suppose?"
"Excellent."
"Glad to hear it." They looked at one another, rather embarrassed.
"Well, I have an engagement with a friend upstairs. I'll leave you. So long?"
Hurstwood nodded his head.
"Damn it all," he murmured, turning toward the door. "I knew that would happen."
He walked several blocks up the street.
His watch only registered 1:30. He tried to think of some place to go or something to do. The day was so bad he wanted only to be inside. Finally, his feet began to feel wet and cold, and he boarded a car. This took him to 59th Street, which was as good as anywhere else. Landed here, he turned to walk back along 7th Avenue, but the slush was too much. The misery of lounging about with nowhere to go became intolerable. He felt as if he were catching cold. Stopping at a corner, he waited for a car southbound. This was no day to be out. He would go home. Carrie was surprised to see him at 3:15. "It's a miserable day out," was all he said. Then he took off his coat and changed his shoes. That night he felt a cold coming on and took quinine. He was feverish until morning and sat about the next day while Carrie waited on him. He was a helpless creature in sickness, not very handsome in a dull-colored bath gown and his hair uncombed. He looked haggard about the eyes and quite old. Carrie noticed this, and it did not appeal to her. She wanted to be good-natured and sympathetic, but something about the man held her aloof. Toward evening, he looked so badly in the weak light that she suggested he go to bed. "You'd better sleep alone," she said. "You'll feel better. I'll open your bed for you now." "All right," he said. As she did all these things, she was in a most despondent state. What a life! What a life! Was her one thought. Once, during the day, when he sat near the radiator, hunched up and reading, she passed through and, seeing him, wrinkled her brows. In the front room, where it was not so warm, she sat by the window and cried. This was the life cut out for her, was it? To live cooped up in a small flat with someone who was out of work, idle, and indifferent to her? She was merely a servant to him now, nothing more. This crying made her eyes red, and when, in preparing his bed, she lighted the gas and, having prepared it, called him in, he noticed the fact. "What's the matter with you?" he asked, looking into her face. His voice was hoarse, and his unkempt head only added to its gruesome quality. "Nothing," said Carrie weakly. "You've been crying," he said. "I haven't either," she answered. It was not for love of him, that he knew. "You needn't cry," he said, getting into bed. "Things will come out all right." In a day or two he was up again, but rough weather holding, he stayed in. The Italian news dealer now delivered the morning papers, and these he read assiduously. A few times after that he ventured out, but meeting another of his old-time friends, he began to feel uneasy sitting about hotel corridors. Every day he came home early, and at last made no pretense of going anywhere. Winter was no time to look for anything. Naturally, being about the house, he noticed the way Carrie did things. She was far from perfect in household methods and economy, and her little deviations on this score first caught his eye. Not, however, before her regular demand for her allowance became a grievous thing. Sitting around as he did, the weeks seemed to pass very quickly. Every Tuesday, Carrie asked for her money. "Do you think we live as cheaply as we might?" he asked one Tuesday morning. "I do the best I can," said Carrie. Nothing was added to this at the moment, but the next day he said, "Do you ever go to the Gonsvoort market over here?" "I didn't know there was such a market," said Carrie. "They say you can get things lots cheaper there." Carrie was very indifferent to the suggestion. These were things which she did not like at all. "How much do you pay for a pound of meat?" he asked one day. "Oh, there are different prices," said Carrie. "Sirloin steak is 22 cents. "That's steep, isn't it?" he answered. So he asked about other things, until finally, with the passing days, it seemed to become a mania with him. He learned the prices and remembered them. His errand-running capacity also improved. It began in a small way, of course. Carrie, going to get her hat one morning, was stopped by him.
"Where are you going, Carrie?" he asked.
"Over to the baker's," she answered.
"I'd just as leave go for you," he said.
She acquiesced, and he went. Each afternoon he would go to the corner for the papers.
"Is there anything you want?" he would say.
By degrees she began to use him. Doing this, however, she lost the weekly payment of $12. "You want to pay me today?" she said one Tuesday, about this time.
"How much?" he asked.
She understood well enough what it meant. "Well, about $5, she answered. "I owe the coal man."
The same day, he said, "I think this Italian up here on the corner sells coal at 25 cents a bushel. I'll trade with him."
Carrie heard this with indifference. "All right," she said. Then it came to be, "George, I must have some coal today," or, "You must get some meat of some kind for dinner." He would find out what she needed and order. Accompanying this plan came skimpiness.
"I only got a half pound of steak," he said, coming in one afternoon with his papers. "We never seem to eat very much."
These miserable details ate the heart out of Carrie. They blackened her days and grieved her soul. Oh, how this man had changed. All day and all day here he sat reading his papers. The world seemed to have no attraction. Once in a while he would go out, in fine weather, it might be 4 or 5 hours, between 11 and 4. She could do nothing but view him with gnawing contempt. It was apathy with Hurstwood, resulting from his inability to see his way out. Each month drew from his small store. Now he had only $500 left, and this he hugged, half feeling as if he could stave off absolute necessity for an indefinite period. Sitting around the house, he decided to wear some old clothes he had. This came first with the bad days. Only once he apologized in the very beginning. "It's so bad today. I'll just wear these around." Eventually, these became the permanent thing. Also, he had been wont to pay 15 cents for a shave and a tip of 10 cents. In his first distress, he cut down the tip to 5, then to nothing. Later he tried a 10-cent barber shop, and, finding that the shave was satisfactory, patronized regularly. Later still he put off shaving to every other day, then to every third, and so on, until once a week became the rule. On Saturday he was a sight to see. Of course, as his own self-respect vanished, it perished for him in Carrie. She could not understand what had gotten into the man. He had some money. He had a decent suit remaining. He was not bad-looking when dressed up. She did not forget her own difficult struggle in Chicago, but she did not forget either that she had never ceased trying. He never tried. He did not even consult the ads in the papers anymore. Finally, a distinct impression escaped from her. "What makes you put so much butter on the steak?" he asked her one evening, standing around in the kitchen. "To make it good, of course," she answered. "Butter is awful dear these days," he suggested. "You wouldn't mind it if you were working," she answered. He shut up after this and went into his paper, but the retort rankled in his mind. It was the first cutting remark that had come from her. That same evening, Carrie, after reading, went off to the front room to bed. This was unusual. When Hurstwood decided to go, he retired, as usual, without a light. It was then that he discovered Carrie's absence. "That's funny," he said. "Maybe she's sitting up." He gave the matter no more thought, but slept. In the morning, she was not beside him. Strange to say, this passed without comment. Night approaching, and a slightly more conversational feeling prevailing, Carrie said, "I think I'll sleep alone tonight. I have a headache." "All right," said Hurstwood. The third night she went to her front bed without apologies. This was a grim blow to Hurstwood,
but he never mentioned it.
All right, he said to himself with an irrepressible frown. Let her sleep alone.
36. A grim retrogression. The phantom of chance. The Vances, who had been back in the city ever since Christmas, had not forgotten Carrie, but they, or rather Mrs. Vance, had never called on her for the very simple reason that Carrie had never sent her address. True to her nature, she corresponded with Mrs. Vance as long as she still lived in 78th Street. But when she was compelled to move into 13th, her fear that the latter would take it as an indication of reduced circumstances caused her to study some way avoiding the necessity of giving her address. Not finding any convenient method, she sorrowfully resigned the privilege of writing to her friend entirely. The latter wondered at this strange silence, thought Carrie must have left the city, and in the end gave her up as lost. So she was thoroughly surprised to encounter her in 14th Street, where she had gone shopping. Carrie was there for the same purpose.
"Why, Mrs. Wheeler," said Mrs. Vance, looking Carrie over in a glance, "where have you been? Why haven't you been to see me? I've been wondering all this time what had become of you. Really, I'm so glad to see you," said Carrie, pleased and yet nonplussed. Of all times, this was the worst to encounter Mrs. Vance. "Why, I'm living downtown here. I've been intending to come and see you. Where are you living now?"
"In 58th Street," said Mrs. Vance, "just off 7th Avenue, 218. Why don't you come and see me?"
"I will," said Carrie. "Really, I've been wanting to come. I know I ought to. It's a shame, but you know..."
"What's her number?" said Mrs. Vance.
13th Street," said Carrie reluctantly. 112 West."
"Oh," said Mrs. Vance. "That's right near here, isn't it?"
"Yes," said Carrie. "You must come down and see me sometime."
"Well, you're a fine one," said Mrs. Vance, laughing, the while noting that Carrie's appearance had modified somewhat. "The address, too," she added to herself. "They must be hard up." Still, she liked Carrie well enough to take her in tow. "Come with me in here a minute," she exclaimed, turning into a store. When Carrie returned home, there was Hurstwood, reading as usual. He seemed to take his condition with the utmost nonchalance. His beard was at least 4 days old. "Oh," thought Carrie, "if she were to come here and see him..." She shook her head in absolute misery. It looked as if her situation was becoming unbearable. Driven to desperation, she asked at dinner, "Did you ever hear any more from that wholesale house?" "No," he said. "They don't want an inexperienced man." Carrie dropped the subject, feeling unable to say more. "I met Mrs. Vance this afternoon," she said after a time.
"Did eh?" he answered.
"They're back in New York now," Carrie went on. "She did look so nice."
"Well, she can afford it as long as he puts up for it," returned Hurstwood. "He's got a soft job."
Hurstwood was looking into the paper. He could not see the look of infinite weariness and discontent Carrie gave him.
"She said she thought she'd call here some day."
"She's been long getting round to it, hasn't she?" said Hurstwood, with a kind of sarcasm. The woman didn't appeal to him from her spending side.
"Oh, I don't know," said Carrie, angered by the man's attitude. "Perhaps I didn't want her to come."
"She's too gay," said Hurstwood significantly. "No one can keep up with her pace unless they've got a lot of money."
"Mr. Vance doesn't seem to find it very hard."
"He may not now," answered Hurstwood doggedly, well understanding the inference, "but his life isn't done yet. You can't tell what'll happen. He may get down like anybody else."
There was something quite knavish in the man's attitude. His eye seemed to be cocked with a twinkle upon the fortunate, expecting their defeat. His own state seemed a thing apart, not considered. This thing was the remains of his old-time cocksureness and independence.
Sitting in his flat and reading of the doings of other people, sometimes this independent, undefeated mood came upon him. Forgetting the weariness of the streets and the degradation of search, he would sometimes prick up his ears. It was as if he said, "I can do something. I'm not down yet. There's a lot of things coming to me if I want to go after them." It was in this mood that he would occasionally dress up, go for a shave, and, putting on his gloves, sally forth quite actively. Not with any definite aim. It was more a barometric condition. He felt just right for being outside and doing something. On such occasions, his money went also. He knew of several poker rooms downtown. A few acquaintances he had in downtown resorts and about the city hall. It was a change to see them and exchange a few friendly commonplaces. He had once been accustomed to hold a pretty fair hand at poker. Many a friendly game had netted him $100 or more at the time when that sum was merely sauce to the dish of the game, not the all in all. Now he thought of playing. "I might win a couple of hundred. I'm not out of practice." It is but fair to say that this thought had occurred to him several times before he acted upon it. The poker room which he first invaded was over a saloon in West Street, near one of the ferries. He had been there before. Several games were going. These he watched for a time, and noticed that the pots were quite large for the ante involved. "Deal me a hand," he said at the beginning of a new shuffle. He pulled up a chair and studied his cards. Those playing made that quiet study of him which is so unapparent and yet invariably so searching. Poor fortune was with him at first. He received a mixed collection without progression or pairs. The pot was opened. "I pass," he said. On the strength of this, he was content to lose his ante. The deals did fairly by him in the long run, causing him to come away with a few dollars to the good. The next afternoon he was back again, seeking amusement and profit. This time he followed up three of a kind to his doom. There was a better hand across the table, held by a pugnacious Irish youth who was a political hanger-on of the Tammany district in which they were located. Hurstwood was surprised at the persistence of this individual, whose bets came with a sang-froid which, if a bluff, was excellent art. Hurstwood began to doubt, but kept, or thought to keep at least, the cool demeanor with which, in olden times, he deceived those psychic students of the gaming table, who seemed to read thoughts and moods rather than exterior evidences, however subtle. He could not down the cowardly thought that this man had something better and would stay to the end, drawing his last dollar into the pot, should he choose to go so far. Still, he hoped to win much. His hand was excellent. Why not raise it five more?
"I raise you three," said the youth.
"Make it five," said Hurstwood, pushing out his chips.
"Come again," said the youth, pushing out a small pile of reds.
"Let me have some more chips," said Hurstwood to the keeper in charge, taking out a bill. A cynical grin lit up the face of his youthful opponent. When the chips were laid out, Hurstwood met the raise.
"Five again," said the youth.
Hurstwood's brow was wet. He was in deep now. Very deep for him. $60 of his good money was up. He was ordinarily no coward, but the thought of losing so much weakened him. Finally, he gave way. He would not trust to this fine hand any longer.
"I call," he said.
"A full house," said the youth, spreading out his cards. Hurstwood's hand dropped.
"I thought I had you," he said weakly.
The youth raked in his chips, and Hurstwood came away, not without first stopping to count his remaining cash on the stair.
$340, he said.
With this loss and ordinary expenses, so much had already gone. Back in the flat, he decided he would play no more. Remembering Mrs. Vance's promise to call, Carrie made one other mild protest. It was concerning Hurstwood's appearance. This very day, coming home, he changed his clothes to the old togs he sat around in.
"What makes you always put on those old clothes?" asked Carrie.
"What's the use of wearing my good ones around here?" he asked.
"Well, I should think you'd feel better."
Then she added, "Someone might call."
"Who?" he said.
"Well, Mrs. Vance," said Carrie. "She needn't see me," he answered sullenly. This lack of pride and interest made Carrie almost hate him.
"Oh," she thought, "there he sits. She needn't see me. I should think he would be ashamed of himself."
The real bitterness of this thing was added when Mrs. Vance did call. It was on one of her shopping rounds. Making her way up the commonplace hall, she knocked at Carrie's door. To her subsequent and agonizing distress, Carrie was out. Hurstwood opened the door, half thinking that the knock was Carrie's. For once, he was honestly taken aback. The lost voice of youth and pride spoke in him.
"Why," he said, actually stammering, "how do you do?"
"How do you do?" said Mrs. Vance, who could scarcely believe her eyes. His great confusion she instantly perceived. He did not know whether to invite her in or not.
"Is your wife at home?" she inquired. "No," he said. "Carrie's out. But won't you step in? She'll be back shortly."
"No," said Mrs. Vance, realizing the change of it all. "I'm really very much in a hurry. I thought I'd just run up and look in, but I couldn't stay. Just tell your wife she must come and see me."
"I will," said Hurstwood, standing back and feeling intense relief at her going. He was so ashamed that he folded his hands weakly as he sat in the chair afterward and thought. Carrie, coming in from another direction, thought she saw Mrs. Vance going away. She strained her eyes but could not make sure.
"Was anybody here just now?" she asked of Hurstwood.
"Yes," he said guiltily, "Mrs. Vance."
"Did she see you?" she asked, expressing her full despair. This cut Hurstwood like a whip and made him sullen.
"If she had eyes, she did. I opened the door."
"Oh," said Carrie, closing one hand tightly out of sheer nervousness. "What did she have to say?"
"Nothing," he answered. "She couldn't stay."
"And you looking like that," said Carrie, throwing aside a long reserve.
"What of it?" he said, angering. "I didn't know she was coming, did I?"
"You knew she might," said Carrie. "I told you she said she was coming. I've asked you a dozen times to wear your other clothes. Oh, I think this is just terrible."
"Oh, let up," he answered. "What difference does it make? You couldn't associate with her anyway. They got too much money."
"Who said I wanted to?" said Carrie fiercely.
"Well, you act like it, rowing over my looks. You'd think I'd committed—" Carrie interrupted him.
"It's true," she said. "I couldn't if I wanted to. But whose fault is it? You're very free to sit and talk about who I could associate with. Why don't you get out and look for work?"
This was a thunderbolt in camp.
"What's it to you?" he said, rising almost fiercely. "I pay the rent, don't I? I furnish the—"
"Yes, you pay the rent," said Carrie. "You talk as if there was nothing else in the world but a flat to sit around in. You haven't done a thing for 3 months except sit around and interfere here. I'd like to know what you married me for."
"I didn't marry you," he said in a snarling tone.
"I'd like to know what you did then in Montreal," she answered.
"Well, I didn't marry you," he answered. "You can get that out of your head. You talk as though you didn't know."
Carrie looked at him a moment, her eyes distending. She had believed it was all legal and binding enough.
"What did you lie to me for then?" she asked fiercely. "What did you force me to run away with you for?"
Her voice became almost a sob.
"Force," he said with a curled lip. a lot of forcing I did.
Oh,
said Carrie, breaking under the strain and turning.
Oh, oh,
and she hurried into the front room. Hurstwood was now hot and waked up. It was a great shaking up for him, both mental and moral. He wiped his brow as he looked around, and then went for his clothes and dressed. Not a sound came from Carrie. She ceased sobbing when she heard him dressing. She thought, at first, with the faintest alarm, of being left without money, not of losing him, though he might be going away permanently. She heard him open the top of the wardrobe and take out his hat. Then the dining room door closed, and she knew he had gone. After a few moments of silence, she stood up, dry-eyed, and looked out the window. Hurstwood was just strolling up the street from the flat toward 6th Avenue. The latter made progress along 13th and across 14th Street to Union Square. Look for work, he said to himself. Look for work. She tells me to get out and look for work. He tried to shield himself from his own mental accusation, which told him that she was right. What a cursed thing that Mrs. Vance's call was, anyhow, he thought. Stood right there and looked me over. I know what she was thinking. He remembered the few times he had seen her in 78th Street. She was always a swell looker, and he had tried to put on the air of being worthy of such as she in front of her. Now to think she had caught him looking this way. He wrinkled his forehead in his distress. The devil, he said a dozen times in an hour. It was a quarter after four when he left the house. Carrie was in tears. There would be no dinner that night. What the deuce, he said, swaggering mentally to hide his own shame from himself. I'm not so bad. I'm not down yet. He looked around the square, and seeing the several large hotels, decided to go to one for dinner. He would get his papers and make himself comfortable there. He ascended into the fine parlor of the Morton House, then one of the best New York hotels, and finding a cushioned seat, read. It did not trouble him much that his decreasing sum of money did not allow of such extravagance. Like the morphine fiend, he was becoming addicted to his ease. Anything to relieve his mental distress, to satisfy his craving for comfort. He must do it. No thoughts for the morrow. He could not stand to think of it any more than he could of any other calamity. Like the certainty of death, he tried to shut the certainty of soon being without a dollar completely out of his mind, and he came very near doing it. Well-dressed guests moving to and fro over the thick carpets carried him back to the old days. A young lady, a guest of the house, playing a piano in an alcove pleased him. He sat there reading. His dinner cost him $1.50. By 8 o'clock he was through, and then, seeing guests leaving and the crowd of pleasure-seekers thickening outside, wondered where he should go. Not home. Carrie would be up. No, he would not go back there this evening. He would stay out and knock around as a man who was independent, not broke, well might. He bought a cigar and went outside on the corner where other individuals were lounging, brokers, racing people, thespians, his own flesh and blood. As he stood there, he thought of the old evenings in Chicago and how he used to dispose of them. Many's the game he had had. This took him to poker. I didn't do that thing right the other day, he thought, referring to his loss of $60. I shouldn't have weakened. I could have bluffed that fellow down. I wasn't in form, that's what ailed me. Then he studied the possibilities of the game as it had been played, and began to figure how he might have won, in several instances, by bluffing a little harder. I'm old enough to play poker and do something with it. I'll try my hand tonight. Visions of a big stake floated before him. Supposing he did win a couple of hundred, wouldn't he be in it? Lots of sports he knew made their living at this game, and a good living, too. They always had as much as I had, he thought.
So off he went to a poker room in the neighborhood, feeling much as he had in the old days. In this period of self-forgetfulness, aroused first by the shock of argument and perfected by a dinner in the hotel with cocktails and cigars, he was as nearly like the old Hurstwood as he would ever be again. It was not the old Hurstwood, only a man arguing with a divided conscience and lured by a phantom. This poker room was much like the other one, only it was a back room in a better drinking resort. Hurstwood watched a while, and then, seeing an interesting game, joined in. As before, it went easy for a while, he winning a few times and cheering up, losing a few pots and growing more interested and determined on that account. At last, the fascinating game took a strong hold on him. He enjoyed its risks and ventured, on a trifling hand, to bluff the company and secure a fair stake. To his self-satisfaction, intense and strong, he did it. In the height of this feeling, he began to think his luck was with him. No one else had done so well. Now came another moderate hand, and again he tried to open the jackpot on it. There were others there who were almost reading his heart, so close was their observation. "I have three of a kind," said one of the players to himself. "I'll just stay with that fellow to the finish." The result was that bidding began. "I raise you 10. Good. 10 more. Good. 10 again. Right you are." It got to where Hurstwood had $75 up. The other man really became serious. Perhaps this individual, Hurstwood, really did have a stiff hand. "I call," he said. Hurstwood showed his hand. He was done. The bitter fact that he had lost $75 made him desperate. "Let's have another pot," he said grimly. "All right," said the man. Some of the other players quit, but observant loungers took their places. Time passed, and it came to 12 o'clock. Hurstwood held on, neither winning nor losing much. Then he grew weary, and on a last hand lost 20 more. He was sick at heart. At 1:15 in the morning, he came out of the place. The chill, bare streets seemed a mockery of his state. He walked slowly west, little thinking of his row with Carrie. He ascended the stairs and went into his room as if there had been no trouble. It was his loss that occupied his mind. Sitting down on the bedside, he counted his money. There was now but $190 and some change. He put it up and began to undress. "I wonder what's getting into me anyhow," he said. In the morning, Carrie scarcely spoke, and he felt as if he must go out again. He had treated her badly, but he could not afford to make up. Now desperation seized him, and for a day or two, going out thus, he lived like a gentleman, or what he conceived to be a gentleman, which took money. For his escapades, he was soon poorer in mind and body, to say nothing of his purse, which had lost 30 by the process. Then he came down to cold, bitter sense again. "A rent man comes today," said Carrie, greeting him thus indifferently 3 mornings later.
"He does?"
"Yes, this is the second," answered Carrie. Hurstwood frowned. Then, in despair, he got out his purse. "It seems an awful lot to pay for rent," he said. He was nearing his last $100. 37. The Spirit Awakens. New Search for the Gate. It would be useless to explain how in due time the last $50 was in sight. The 700, by his process of handling, had only carried them into June. Before the final 100 mark was reached, he began to indicate that a calamity was approaching. "I don't know," he said one day, taking a trivial expenditure for meat as a text. "It seems to take an awful lot for us to live."
It doesn't seem to me, said Carrie, that we spend very much.
My money is nearly gone, he said, and I hardly know where it's gone to.
All that $700? Asked Carrie.
All but $100.
He looked so disconsolate that it scared her. She began to see that she herself had been drifting. She had felt it all the time.
Well, George, she exclaimed, why don't you get out and look for something? You could find something.
I have looked, he said. You can't make people give you a place.
She gazed weakly at him and said, well, what do you think you will do? $100 won't last long.
I don't know, he said. I can't do any more than look.
Carrie became frightened over this announcement. She thought desperately upon the subject. Frequently she had considered the stage as a door through which she might enter that gilded state which she had so much craved. Now, as in Chicago, it came as a last resource in distress. Something must be done if he did not get work soon. Perhaps she would have to go out and battle again alone. She began to wonder how one would go about getting a place. Her experience in Chicago proved that she had not tried the right way. There must be people who would listen to and try you, men who would give you an opportunity. They were talking at the breakfast table a morning or two later when she brought up the dramatic subject by saying that she saw Sarah Bernhardt was coming to this country. Hurstwood had seen it, too.
How do people get on the stage, George? She finally asked, innocently.
I don't know, he said. There must be dramatic agents.
Carrie was sipping coffee and did not look up.
Regular people who get you a place?
Yes, I think so, he answered.
Suddenly the air with which she asked attracted his attention.
You're not still thinking about being an actress, are you? He asked.
No, she answered. I was just wondering.
Without being clear, there was something in the thought which he objected to. He did not believe any more, after 3 years of observation, that Carrie would ever do anything great in that line. She seemed too simple, too yielding. His idea of the art was that it involved something more pompous. If she tried to get on the stage, she would fall into the hands of some cheap manager and become like the rest of them. He had a good idea of what he meant by them. Carrie was pretty. She would get along all right, but where would he be?
I'd get that idea out of my head if I were you. It's a lot more difficult than you think.
Carrie felt this to contain, in some way, an aspersion upon her ability.
You said I did real well in Chicago, she rejoined.
You did, he answered, seeing that he was arousing opposition. But Chicago isn't New York by a big jump.
Carrie did not answer this at all. It hurt her.
The stage, he went on, is all right if you can be one of the big guns, but there's nothing to the rest of it. It takes a long while to get up.
Oh, I don't know, said Carrie, slightly aroused.
In a flash, he thought he foresaw the result of this thing. Now, when the worst of his situation was approaching, she would get on the stage in some cheap way and forsake him. Strangely, he had not conceived well of her mental ability. That was because he did not understand the nature of emotional greatness. He had never learned that a person might be emotionally instead of intellectually great. Avery Hall was too far away for him to look back and sharply remember. He had lived with this woman too long.
Well, I do, he answered. If I were you, I wouldn't think of it. It's not much of a profession for a woman.
It's better than going hungry, said Carrie. If you don't want me to do that, why don't you get work yourself?
There was no answer ready for this. He had got used to the suggestion.
Oh, let up, he answered.
The result of this was that she secretly resolved to try. It didn't matter about him. She was not going to be dragged into poverty and something worse to suit him. She could act. She could get something and then work up. What would he say then?
She pictured herself already appearing in some fine performance on Broadway, of going every evening to her dressing room and making up. Then she would come out at 11 o'clock and see the carriages ranged about, waiting for the people. It did not matter whether she was the star or not. If she were only once in, getting a decent salary, wearing the kind of clothes she liked, having the money to do with, going here and there as she pleased, how delightful it would all be. Her mind ran over this picture all the day long. Hurstwood's dreary state made its beauty become more and more vivid. Curiously, this idea soon took hold of Hurstwood. His vanishing sum suggested that he would need sustenance. Why could not Carrie assist him a little until he could get something? He came in one day with something of this idea in his mind. "I met John B. Drake today," he said. "He's going to open a hotel here in the fall. He says that he can make a place for me then."
"Who is he?" asked Carrie.
"He's the man that runs the Grand Pacific in Chicago."
"Oh," said Carrie.
"I'd get about $1,400 a year out of that."
"That would be good, wouldn't it?" she said sympathetically.
"If I can only get over this summer," he added, "I think I'll be all right. I'm hearing from some of my friends again."
Carrie swallowed this story in all its pristine beauty. She sincerely wished he could get through the summer. He looked so hopeless. "How much money have you left?"
"Only $50.
"Oh, mercy," she exclaimed. "What will we do? It's only 20 days until the rent will be due again."
Hurstwood rested his head on his hands and looked blankly at the floor. "Maybe you could get something in the stage line," he blandly suggested.
"Maybe I could," said Carrie, glad that someone approved of the idea.
"I'll lay my hand to whatever I can get," he said, now that he saw her brighten up. "I can get something."
She cleaned up the things one morning after he had gone, dressed as neatly as her wardrobe permitted, and set out for Broadway. She did not know that thoroughfare very well. To her it was a wonderful conglomeration of everything great and mighty. The theaters were there. These agencies must be somewhere about. She decided to stop in at the Madison Square Theater and ask how to find the theatrical agents. This seemed the sensible way. Accordingly, when she reached that theater, she applied to the clerk at the box office.
"Eh?" he said, looking out. "Dramatic agents? I don't know. You'll find them in the Clipper, though. They all advertise in that."
"Is that a paper?" said Carrie.
"Yes," said the clerk, marveling at such ignorance of a common fact. "You can get it at the newsstands," he added politely, seeing how pretty the inquirer was.
Carrie proceeded to get the Clipper and tried to find the agents by looking over it as she stood beside the stand. This could not be done so easily. 13th Street was a number of blocks off, but she went back, carrying the precious paper and regretting the waste of time. Hurstwood was already there, sitting in his place.
"Where were you?" he asked.
"I've been trying to find some dramatic agents." He felt a little diffident about asking concerning her success. The paper she began to scan attracted his attention.
"What have you got there?" he asked.
"The Clipper. The man said I'd find their addresses in here."
"Have you been all the way over to Broadway to find that out? I could have told you."
"Why didn't you?" she asked, without looking up.
"You never asked me," he returned.
She went, hunting aimlessly through the crowded columns. Her mind was distracted by this man's indifference. The difficulty of the situation she was facing was only added to by all he did. Self-commiseration brewed in her heart. Tears trembled along her eyelids, but did not fall. Hurstwood noticed something.
"Let me look."
To recover herself, she went into the front room while he searched. Presently, she returned. He had a pencil and was writing upon an envelope.
"Here are three," he said.
Carrie took it and found that one was Mrs. Bermudez, another Marcus Jenks, a third Percy Weil. She
She paused only a moment and then moved toward the door. "I might as well go right away," she said without looking back. Hurstwood saw her depart with some faint stirrings of shame, which were the expression of a manhood rapidly becoming stultified. He sat a while, and then it became too much. He got up and put on his hat.
"I guess I'll go out," he said to himself, and went, strolling nowhere in particular, but feeling somehow that he must go.
Carrie's first call was upon Mrs. Bermudez, whose address was quite the nearest. It was an old-fashioned residence turned into offices. Mrs. Bermudez's office consisted of what formerly had been a back chamber and a hall bedroom marked private. As Carrie entered, she noticed several persons lounging about, men who said nothing and did nothing. While she was waiting to be noticed, the door of the hall bedroom opened, and from it issued two very mannish-looking women, very tightly dressed and wearing white collars and cuffs. After them came a portly lady of about 45, light-haired, sharp-eyed, and evidently good-natured. At least, she was smiling.
"Now don't forget about that," said one of the mannish women.
"I won't," said the portly woman. "Let's see," she added. "Where are you the first week in February?"
"Pittsburgh," said the woman.
"I'll write you there."
"All right," said the other, and the two passed out.
Instantly, the portly lady's face became exceedingly sober and shrewd. She turned about and fixed on Carrie a very searching eye.
"Well," she said, "young woman, what can I do for you?"
"Are you Mrs. Bermudez?"
"Yes."
"Well," said Carrie, hesitating how to begin, "do you get places for persons upon the stage?"
"Yes."
"Could you get me one?"
"Have you ever had any experience?"
"A very little," said Carrie.
"Whom did you play with?"
"Oh, with no one," said Carrie. "It was just a show gotten—"
"Oh, I see," said the woman, interrupting her. "No, I don't know of anything now."
Carrie's countenance fell.
"You want to get some New York experience," concluded the affable Mrs. Bermudez. "We'll take your name, though."
Carrie stood looking while the lady retired to her office. "What is your address?" inquired a young lady behind the counter, taking up the curtailed conversation. "Mrs. George Wheeler," said Carrie, moving over to where she was writing. The woman wrote her address in full and then allowed her to depart at her leisure. She encountered a very similar experience in the office of Mr. Jenks, only he varied it by saying at the close, "If you could play at some local house or had a program with your name on it, I might do something." In the third place, the individual asked, "What sort of work do you want to do?"
"What do you mean?" said Carrie.
"Well, do you want to get in a comedy or on the vaudeville stage or in the chorus?"
"Oh, I'd like to get a part in a play," said Carrie.
"Well," said the man, "it'll cost you something to do that."
"How much?" said Carrie, who, ridiculous as it may seem, had not thought of this before.
"Well, that's for you to say," he answered shrewdly. Carrie looked at him curiously. She hardly knew how to continue the inquiry.
"Could you get me a part if I paid?"
"If we didn't, you'd get your money back."
"Oh," she said.
The agent saw he was dealing with an inexperienced soul and continued accordingly. "You'd want to deposit $50 anyway. No agent would trouble about you for less than that."
Carrie saw a light. "Thank you," she said. "I'll think about it."
She started to go and then bethought herself.
"How soon would I get a place?" she asked.
"Well, that's hard to say," said the man. "You might get one in a week, or..."